Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, joining you once again to dissect another unsolved mystery. In this episode, we're headed to British Columbia, Canada, to take a look at the baffling disappearance of 20-year-old Ryan Stuka, who vanished upon leaving a party near Sun Peaks Resort in the early morning hours of February 17th, 2018, and hasn't been seen or heard from since. In those 4+ years since Ryan's disappearance, extensive searches of the surrounding terrain have revealed no evidence of the young man's remains, leading some to wonder if it's possible he never left the party. So what we're going to endeavor to do is make a structural assessment of the psychology of the events as they're relayed to us, and then speculate about what really might have happened. But first, as always, you can follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at ColdCaseMM for the latest updates regarding episode releases, and of course, your 5-star ratings and reviews wherever you listen help others to find the show. For anyone who'd like to support the show in other ways, I also have a Patreon page, and alternatively, direct donations can be made through the donate link found on the homepage of ColdCaseMurderMysteries.com. Thanks again for all that you do. Let's get into this episode. Okay, so Ryan Stuka is from Beaumont, Alberta, and is the son of parents Scott and Heather. They seem to be a close family, and suggested in the media that when Ryan came to them in 2017 with the idea of going to Sun Peaks to work for the winter 2017-2018 season, it was sort of a big deal because the group had never been separated from one another for any significant period of time over the course of the last 2 decades of Ryan's life. Apparently, Ryan had worked with his father at some point after high school, earning a salary of about $24 per hour, which would mean going to Sun Peaks to work for perhaps $11 an hour or so as a lift operator wasn't something he was going to do for practical purposes related to building a career. Like a lot of young people right out of high school, it seems he went back to college, or university, and decided it wasn't for him at the time, as he didn't seem sure if his chosen field of study would render a solid career path. So he left school for the time being, something a lot of people do because, well, it can be difficult to know what you want for your future without first figuring out who you are as an adult. Some know, but some don't. And for those who don't, a process occurs called finding yourself, whether it means backpacking across Europe, living in a hostel in Costa Rica, or seeking some other type of adventure. In the US and Canada, a very popular method of doing this involves one idea. Go west. You'll find adventure. At a tough time in my life, one in which I needed a fresh start, I packed up and moved to Colorado, where I did nothing but hike mountains for 6 months. I didn't know why until afterward, but in order to reach that understanding about who I really was, I needed a physical canvas upon which to paint the portrait of my authentic self. What was my big concern? I was struggling so badly with the question of how to get up the mountain of life, of how to climb to the top in order to see the view from up there instead of being stuck down at the bottom. So as I needed that clarity emotionally, I used physicality as a means of continually manifesting the reality I wanted to bring to bear psychologically. I couldn't get over the mountain of my problems in my head, and so I decided to put those mountains in front of me, quite literally, so that I could face something head on and win. Climbing those hills never changed my life in a way that can be quantified, as I was using a physical solution to compensate for an emotional issue. But the lesson I learned, which was unavoidable after hiking so many mountainsides, is that it is not easy to get to the top of any of them. Each one is a distinctly different challenge, but no matter where you turn, it's hard. There is no shortcut to the top. There is no way up, but through. I used to try new ones all the time, and each time I would believe that finally I was going to come upon a hill that was enjoyable to climb. I never did. In fact, the only thing I learned is that I don't like climbing or hiking mountains. Like most people, I simply enjoy the reward of having climbed them. And so, it occurred to me that no matter where I go in life, the path to the top will be comprised of endless suffering. So, wherever I'm going to go has to really be worth it. There is no easy way to ascend to the place in which your authentic self resides. Yet, as young people, we fear the oncoming necessity of transcendence and often run from it, both on the map and in our hearts, leaving us to manifest our problem in physicality. It takes me about 2 seconds to realize Ryan Stuka had the same issue I did, and that most people have. So what we can expect to see here is that the job he left home to get at Sun Peaks manifests the same idealistic vision as what I anticipated, which is that there is an easier way up the mountain. This isn't optional. It's structural necessity. Therefore, Ryan goes to Sun Peaks and gets a job doing what? He's a lift operator. All day, he manifests the idea of people getting to the top of the mountain with the greatest of ease, completely absent of strife and suffering, and as a bonus, he gets to be the powerful hand of God, so to speak, who gives them that magical ability. So what we understand from that action is that he's an empathetic person and realizes all too well that other people have internal lives, as he is manifesting that same idea of helping them up the mountain of their problems so that they may enjoy the ease and relaxation of coming down the other side. As the lift operator, he is literally the person with the power to help people get up this mountain. And it's beautiful on a symbolic level because that's who we're supposed to be. People who realize that by helping others get up the mountain of their issues, we climb our own as well. And I think that's what's going on in Ryan's life during this time period. Most of what we learn and most of what causes us to evolve happens in our ignorance and in the form of symbolic narratives lending physically born enlightenment to our emotional ignorance. It's simply intuitive. As Ryan helps these people up and down the mountain and realizes the rewards it offers him as well, he might not indulge in explicit understanding of this give and take, but it will permeate his thoughts so that when he leaves this resort and takes on another challenge of greater magnitude, that notion of helping people get to the top will become explicit. Now, in a tragedy, what physically manifests is the mirrored version of your intentions. Everything is reversed. So if Ryan goes to Sun Peaks with the intention of helping people thrive and be free by getting them to the top of the mountain, and a tragedy occurs, then he is going to die in a circumstance which dictates another person helps him down the mountain where he gets stuck or trapped. And it will be one man at the controls in the same way Ryan was on the lift. In fact, the method by which Ryan will have gone down the mountain also needs to be the same as what he used to get the people up it. So if he used a lift, what popular mode of transportation should we seek to uncover here that is used to give people a lift? Well, a common form of slang from the past in terms of giving somebody a ride is called giving them a lift. So what we're looking for here is a car or a similar vehicle. It could be a truck. But essentially, we are looking for one man and one vehicle. Now, when the people go up in the lift, Ryan is alive, in control, and outside the lift. He doesn't go with them. So when he goes down the hill in the car, those values will be reversed by way of necessity, meaning he will be dead, not in control, inside the vehicle, and he goes along for the ride. So again, using that emotional mirror, since Ryan's passengers on the lift unload themselves upon reaching the top, when he's dumped at the bottom or down the hill, someone else will remove him from the vehicle. Your physical reality is simply a mirrored version of your emotional world, and it comes through the conduit of symbolic resonance. So, even before I begin the heart of my analysis, I know I'm primarily looking for one man, someone older than Ryan, meaning someone who originally came here for the same lesson Ryan wanted, but never left to implement what he'd learned. This is a person who has never truly known the hardship of getting up the hill, and so, faced with his steepest climb yet, he did what he'd always done, which was to take his problems down the hill and submerge them in the abyss of the dark waters of the unconscious mind, where they'll remain hidden and unrealized. That's what immature people do. They try to suppress and ignore their problems instead of fighting to get up the hill. That's where the weak take their unsuspecting prey, down the hill. And they do it because that place on the hill, or down the hill, is the place where the perpetrator's emotional life became stifled heading into adulthood. He couldn't get up the hill. When you refuse emotional change, those psychological monsters manifest in physicality and come for you. Ryan obviously came to this place to learn some lessons about getting up the hill to the top of the mountain in life, and was indulging that symbolism in a healthy way in the form of being a lift operator. He watches the lift take everybody up the hill with the greatest of ease, but what do we all know is the truth emotionally? There is no such lift. You have to climb that mountain. So that lesson over time is one Ryan would absorb implicitly. And furthermore, think of it like this. He's only supposed to be at this place temporarily for something like 4 or 5 months. And that's the point. He's here to learn that lesson about getting up the hill. That's how we grow, intuitively. You are living a symbolic rendering of your emotional life in physicality. That's it. But here's the thing. To be the transcendent character, or the Jesus character, meaning the agent of change, you must be both the student and the teacher. The reason is that if you don't know how to be a student, you could never understand how to be a teacher. Obviously, our educational systems are all set up like that as well. You must first be the student, and only then can you be the teacher. All of which is to say, if you never learn the lesson as a student, what will you disseminate as a teacher? Well, if what you are supposed to learn is emotional maturity through psychological growth to get to the top of the mountain, then the opposite would be emotional stagnancy delivered by physically manifested sociopathy that takes you in the opposite direction, which is down to hell. So what I see in this narrative is that an unqualified teacher or older employee gave instructions to his naive students or younger employees that physically took them down the hill with lies rather than emotionally driving them to the top with truth. That which drives us to the top of the mountain in life is emotional. So in physically manifested narratives born of sociopathy, it's actually a vehicle driving us. It's a shortcut to the hard work of climbing on our own, a la the chairlift and someone's car. Likewise, when you want to get to the top of the mountain emotionally, but don't want to put in the hard work of changing over time, you shortcut that notion of quote-unquote getting high by using drugs to temporarily make you feel that way. So young people, as they aren't often yet in the process of climbing that mountain to the place where they want to be, substitute getting high. But the lower you go emotionally, the higher you have to get, so to speak. What I see here is that Ryan, at 20 years old and indulging a manifested narrative, didn't need to get as high as his older counterpart or teacher in this situation because he was younger and not yet refusing emotional change. Ryan was learning what was necessary to get to the top of the mountain, and therefore, in this early stage, in the same way people use gateway drugs, he wouldn't have perceived the necessity of getting as high as someone else who had already been down that road, learned the lesson, and decided not to change. people like that want us to join them because, quite simply, misery loves company. We don't like watching people rise while we're stuck in the mud below. So as we move into the narrative now, think of someone older Ryan runs into, meaning a teacher, so to speak, offering him physical means of doing what? Getting higher than he already is. How would that manifest? Well, again, just like a gateway drug works, when a person realizes they can achieve certain heights emotionally, but no greater, and can erase pain to a certain extent, but no greater, they seek usage of something, a vehicle, so to speak, that will get them higher. Now, if you wanted to go higher up that hill of manufactured emotion, but got too high and it killed you, to where would you be taken physically to achieve balance? Think of it in a manifested way. Down the hill, right? Balance is a zero charge, a universe where nothing is created or destroyed. So if you get too high, you try to come down. But if you get too high and don't come down, the person who was responsible for getting you too high, meaning the one supplying the drugs, will physically take you there in a manifested narrative. That's exactly where I think Ryan ended up, and how. So let's indulge this enigma now. Ryan and his friend James moved from Alberta to Sun Peaks in BC after getting seasonal employment at Sun Peaks Resort, which would have kept Ryan there from December 1st, 2017 until April 16th, 2018. So at the time of his disappearance, on February 17th, 2018, he'd been living and working in the Sun Peaks area for 10 weeks or so. It seems like a time frame conducive to getting a strong understanding of the local area in which he reside and are employed, but not the surrounding area. It stands to reason Ryan could easily get lost in the wilderness by wandering off under the influence of alcohol and drugs in very cold weather. So anyhow, Ryan and his friend from home, James, rent a shared room in a house on Sun Peaks Road, which gives them three other roommates, I believe. Ryan and James have bunk beds in a small bedroom. There's also a male-female couple, and also one other female roommate. I'm just a little unclear on the makeup of this group. There could be one more person involved here, but I think this is approximately correct. It doesn't really seem to matter much, as the roommate's house isn't directly involved, or so we believe. On the morning of February 16th, Ryan indulges his usual routine of snowboarding before work, and then works what I believe is his normal shift from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. He also makes time to pay bills online, and goes to an ATM to get cash. He was expecting to go out partying over the next two nights and wanted to budget accordingly, but ironically ended up spending all the money the first night, foreshadowing the extent of his intoxication. Whatever he intended as being his limit is something he ultimately ignored. So if we see that idea in his decision, it will also, very likely, be the thing that killed him. But we'll get to that. For now, Ryan is off work on the evening of February 16th, and the way the universe writes its material is that it shows you the lesson you really needed to understand right before it pushes you off a cliff called tragedy. So if Ryan is ultimately going to end up in a vehicle being taken somewhere because he got sick and couldn't recover, the lesson that will precipitate that rendering will be one in which he literally utilizes a vehicle, like the chairlift, but in combination with increased empathy or emotional growth, to magically help someone become free and well again, contradicting his fate of never recovering from sickness and being trapped forever. Accordingly, Ryan learns he has a sick friend nearby who needs his help, specifically doing what? Getting up and down the mountain, because the guy is sick and can't go out to get the things he needs. Look at this opportunity for growth. Like the chairlift, Ryan can use the physicality of his vehicle, but in combination with empathy, to say, I want to help this person get up the mountain to recovery. I want them to be okay again. So he does that for someone. He makes sacrifices of both his time and resources to help another person get up the hill to a place where they can start to feel better again. This is how we learn. Intuitively, this is why your reality is constructed like this. You are not supposed to be explicitly aware of it. It is only supposed to be a very few insane, neurodivergent people who understand the construction of these things so that they can simply tell you when you would like to learn about it and you don't have to be inundated by this shit 24 hours a day like I am. You don't want to see these things, right? You only need to understand them when we indulge situations like this. So most of what you experience is intuitive. Therefore, your physical reality has to be an architectural roadmap derived from emotional necessity and rendering symbolism. That's how we'll identify what happened here. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Life can be overwhelming, and many people are burned out without even knowing it. Symptoms can include lack of motivation, feeling helpless or trapped, detachment, fatigue, and more. In my own life, I often get drained from working hard and feel like I need to take a step back to sort through some personal issues. We often associate burnout with work, but that's not the only cause. Any of our roles in life can lead us to feel burned out, and BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you to prioritize yourself. Talking with someone can help you figure out what's causing stress in your life. So why wait to see what this service can do for you? Now is the time to see what benefits BetterHelp Online Therapy offers. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Cold Case Murder Mysteries listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/CCMM. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, .com/CCMM. So as we see Ryan indulge this emotional growth, what we understand will later kill him has to be a version of himself that would refuse this change. A person like him, but someone who refused to make sacrifices to get others to the top of the mountain emotionally. To the contrary, it will be someone who makes physical sacrifices of others to go down the hill. The bottom. So if you go online and search for the last photo of Ryan Stuka, what's the name of the establishment where the image is taken? It's called Bottoms. That's where we're going. The abyss. More on that soon. But for now, Ryan gets back home after helping his friend and doesn't seem to have a lot of time to get ready. One account says he chugs a beer before heading out the door, and another says he has a couple of beers. I really don't know the truth, or if there's even an appreciable difference between the two. Anyhow, they intend to go to a silent disco at Bottoms Bar and Grill, but upon arriving, it seems there's a long line to get in, and the doors for this silent disco party aren't open yet, so the group goes elsewhere for a drink. Now, for those who aren't familiar with the idea of a silent disco, it's basically the same thing as going to a nightclub with really loud music, except in this case, all of that booming bass takes place inside a pair of headphones you rent in exchange for your driver's license. Now, in a symbolically rendered narrative, what is implied by the usage of headphones? It's going to tell us everything we need to know about how to search for the truth about Ryan. If you wear headphones, as Ryan is seen doing in the last photo ever taken of him, what can we say definitively? Well, everything that drives the movements of the participants, meaning the truth about why they're dancing or behaving in that specific way at the bar, happens inside the housing of the headphones. Outside the housing of the headphones is only ignorance. So if you go inside, the truth about why people are acting this way is available. But if you remain outside, you only receive ignorance about what is really driving people to behave this way. That needs to be understood on a symbolic level, and that intuition needs to be made explicit in order for us to understand. So, likewise, in the search for Ryan, the focus has been strongly geared toward everything outside the housing from which he disappeared. And accordingly, right in line with the universe's lesson disseminated by way of the headphones, those interested in knowing what happened to drive such behavior are left entirely ignorant because the truth is only available inside. Now, if you don't see the apparent symbolism in the idea of driving the truth through these actions, just consider what I said you need to turn over to the employees at this bar and grill to get the headphones. Your driver's license. So someone outside the housing of the headphones is emotionally driving Ryan toward the truth inside his headphones housing, which means his disappearance will reverse that. Someone inside the housing, aka the party house on Burfield Drive, will drive the truth, meaning Ryan, away. The idea, in both cases, is simply this. Keep the ignorance positioned on the outside. And why? That's how everything stays quiet. The people on the outside of the headphones won't know how to dance to the music because they don't know the song being played. That's the same reason Ryan's disappearance has not been solved. You can't dance to the beat of this drum leading back to the truth unless you do what the headphones are telling us. Go inside. So we'll do that. For now, because there's a long line at Bottoms and the place isn't quite open for the silent disco yet, Ryan and his group go to another bar and grill. Now, up front, what I'm about to say is probably going to sound insane to your likely neurotypical ears, but bear with me for a moment. What I believe killed Ryan is the straight line, specifically the straight line of the white light, and even more specifically, the disappearing straight line of the white light, which is a manifestation of the Holy Ghost or Holy Spirit. It is not permanent. Essentially, our universe is no more than a straight line of white light derived from alternating currents of electricity like you get from your wall socket. So that white line appears and disappears repetitively. At this point in the night, Ryan, according to his friend James, has been taking MDMA, something more commonly known under the monikers of Molly or Ecstasy. James, according to Ryan's mother Heather, initially didn't want to divulge that Ryan had been taking such drugs, but ultimately told her that Ryan had consumed MDMA 3 times over that night, meaning 3 tabs, doses, or hits, whichever term you prefer. By most accounts, that's a significant amount to consume, and one could expect to be pretty high. We don't know the timing of the consumption, so it would be unfair to believe he was really out of control or on the verge of tragedy without knowing better. One could easily consume that much MDMA and not realize there was a problem until it was too late. And if there is one thing, above and beyond anything else, that takes MDMA usage from dangerous to deadly, it is none other than that repetitively disappearing straight white line we like to call cocaine. A person using a significant amount of MDMA combined with alcohol could potentially expect severe hyperthermia by way of dehydration to become a problem. But a person combining cocaine with those things is begging for it. What's worse is they don't know it. They don't feel hot. They feel warm in a good way and happy, but the reason cocaine is such a deal breaker is that it hits the gas pedal on cardiac function in a situation in which your fan is broken and you're out of oil. You can't cool the engine anymore. So in the same way it happens in a car, if you're not monitoring the temperature or oil gauges, at some point the vehicle overheats, and when it does, it seizes. It can't be fixed. Nobody gets in their car hell-bent on making it overheat and die. That's the last thing they want. But it happens so often due to one factor. Ignorance. You don't know it's overheating until it's too late. The people driving the car are not under the hood to see what's going wrong when it happens. They only learn after they see the smoke rising from it. When the symptoms are not only more prevalent and by extension more severe, but prevention is also an irreconcilable idea when pitted against your current reality. It's tragedy. Because you remained outside, in ignorance, truth remained mystery. But if your car breaks down, what do? Even if it's too late? You lift the hood, look inside, and see the truth that is not available outside the car. That's what needs to happen in this case. It sounds like Ryan's parents, Heather and Scott, along with family, friends, and other interested parties, like the Kamloops RCMP, have done an amazing job of searching for Ryan outside the home where he was last seen, in addition to the surrounding area. But like the people standing outside the car and knowing there's smoke coming from under the hood, the best course of action moving forward, in my opinion, is to go back inside to find the truth. The necessity here is about balance. What I see is a very strong and definitive effort to search every nook and cranny outside the home for the truth. It's quite honorable, and undoubtedly, I wouldn't be able to fully understand the blood, sweat, and tears that went into this massive undertaking. It takes courage to keep searching, especially in the face of such an expansive and daunting terrain. But within that consideration, it's also easy for me to understand that if I asked anybody involved if they'd searched the hearts and minds of the people who last saw Ryan inside that house with the same unrelenting vigor as they endeavored to bring to their exterior search, the answer, without question, would be no. What I see on the outside of the house is a thorough, nuanced, and meticulous undertaking to search the landscape. Yet, to the contrary, what I see happening inside the house is a cursory examination in comparison, one that settles for bullshit reason, logic, and rationalizations that lie in stark contrast to a huge effort outside the home. That's not anyone's fault. It's just a result of primitive and ineffective investigative means. Asking people if they did it is not an effective tool, and with respect to the agencies involved, I don't believe they went any further simply because they don't know how and perhaps don't have the resources. And if there was perhaps an overdose involved, the only physical evidence left at the scene would likely be that of Ryan's presence and nothing more, rather than a bloodbath that might occur in a murder, leaving forensic evidence all over the place. That means law enforcement would likely not find definitive physical evidence in relation to a crime, and since Ryan was admittedly there that night, simply proving that he was, and nothing more, doesn't have a lot of value. But we're not law enforcement. We can speculate openly about what we think. So what I'm going to attempt to do here is map what should have been the investigative course in this case as it relates to going inside. Again, things are about to get very weird for a few minutes, but I think you'll see the purpose of presenting these ideas once we get further into the narrative. Now, think of a pool table, or a billiards table if you prefer. I'm going to break that table down into the context of our universe and its functionality. Okay, so our universe is essentially a two-dimensional canvas that is given a third dimension by our perception of depth, which translates to time. In a two-dimensional format, the universe, without time, exists all at once, happening at once. Yet by way of our eyes, or senses, and therefore our brains, our measured perception creates a third dimension in which everything on the two-dimensional canvas is suddenly afforded depth, such as circles turning into spheres, like the Earth. That happens through the conduit of something not unlike what you know today as a green screen, which allows massless two-dimensional creations of light, such as VFX, animation, etc., to interact with three-dimensional creatures comprised of mass or matter, such as humans. So, on the pool table, the green surface upon which you play is two-dimensional, has no mass, and only directly interacts with the game or story as far as movement goes, just like the green screen. Now, the color green is used because it's the middle of the traditional color scale of Roy G. Biv, or red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, with those respective sides bookended by black, ironically the absence of color, and white, the combination of them all. So the balls that start and end the game are the white cue ball and the black 8 ball, or the totality of all colors in white and the absence of them all in black. We understand the context of cue ball, meaning to cue or start the beginning of the game, but if we examine a literal capital Q, we see a straight line combined with a circle. That's what pool replicates. Not surprisingly, the stick used in this game is also called a cue. So it's the straight line and circle combining, or pool cue and cue ball colliding, that creates what effect that is very commonly associated with the feeling of using MDMA in the form of Molly or ecstasy. That, of course, would be rolling. If you're high on these things, you're rolling. That's what it's called. Now, why do we need to take a closer look at this? Well, just notice what the cue ball also does. The cue stick striking the cue ball causes that white circle or sphere to become what as it moves? A straight white line that eventually disappears. Now, blue starts the right or light half of the color scale, if you will. Or perhaps it would be more specific to say that half of the color scale is headed toward white, or the combination of all colors. So in these cases, the universe often throws up a blue-white flag to let you know it's doing business. A legendary example would be Bridge Guy in the Delphi Murders wearing a blue coat along with what seems to be a white scarf on his neck. Here, in this case, we have Ryan wearing a blue coat, and like Bridge Guy, though he is obviously not a killer, when he walks into his first destination that fateful night and unzips his blue coat, what's the first color you'll see beneath? White. He's wearing a gray and white shirt that's white on the front. Now, why do we care? Well, guess what the most popular color of ecstasy is? Blue, at 58%, according to one source, while white is second at 52%. Now, which one do we concern ourselves with here? Well, remember that theme about Ryan learning the difference between using a vehicle like the Lyft to take the easy way to the top of the mountain and using his own vehicle to make the sacrifice to help a friend? Well, we just ask, which of these is named after a vehicle? Well, we have the Blue Dolphin and the White Mercedes. Mercedes it is. That's his vehicle to get to the top of the mountain that night, so to speak. So again, look at that. He's using a vehicle to get to the top of the mountain. He's taking the lift. It's giving him a lift. So if we simply reverse that and ask ourselves where he ended up, it's down the mountain and by way of a vehicle. Now, in what form do we find this white Mercedes? It's a white circle. That's our cue ball. Now, like the cue ball and cue stick combining to make the disappearing white straight line through movement, I believe the potential circle and disappearing straight line of the MDMA and cocaine combining might have had, for lack of a better term, a beer before liquor never sicker effect on a person's body. Again, please excuse the crude terminology. While I am definitely not any type of medical professional, the one thing that's apparent to me is that when your body is working in overdrive, you can't put the gas pedal to the floor or something's going to give eventually. Like the car analogy I gave earlier, if you ignore its necessity for cooling, it seizes, and once it does, you've reached the end of the line. Like the engine begging in silence for oil, but the owner ignoring it, on a cold night while you were downing beers and taking some MDMA, you would likely be unaware that you were in danger until it was too late, unfortunately. Now, the cue ball and pull cue are physically supported by the bridge created by the table. So what we understand is that bridge, so to speak, in its naming, will also tell us the emotional reason for why Ryan was using drugs that night. So to the best of our comprehension at this point in history, we now see that everything projected onto the universe's canvas, from massless movement of light to objects with mass, likely happens through string theory, or the idea that a network of strings or fibers, by way of vibration leading to sound and light, projects the reality we see. Therefore, all of our sensory experiences have to be derived from feeling, from speech to hearing, and so on. There is nothing else, even emotionally, only feeling. So the pool table, while technologically inferior, will offer the same values. That green screen, so to speak, the canvas upon which the game is played, is comprised of exactly that idea. It's a network of strings or fibers across which everything moves and is projected onto the green screen called what? What is the name of the material that covers the pool table? Just think of the context of feeling again. What's the material on the pool table called? Felt. It's called felt. Therefore, what Ryan sought through the drug usage is obviously feeling. He wanted to get high, and if he took 3 hits, it stands to reason he repetitively indulged the idea of getting higher, specifically in terms of feeling. This was all about how he what? How he felt. Just like the screen. That's the story. So that's what's on the green screen of life for us in this case. Now, the universal structure for completion is birth, life, death, deity. And the deity is specifically the disappearing straight white line, or if you're religious, the transformation of the Holy Ghost into God to complete his disembodiment. That means when the disappearing straight line comes into play, through structural necessity, the Christ character, or transcendent one, has to die. And again, in this case, though this is a tragedy, Ryan is in that role. So what that psychological narrative says to me is that the 3 hits of MDMA were akin to birth, life, death, as they led him to the place in which he would become disembodied. However, since it's a tragedy, he doesn't emerge from below in the womb or abyss like Christ. He remains there down in that darkness. But symbolically, due to sociopathic intentions, the universe will still manifest the idea of Ryan's deification in the sense that, like God, he still exists, but can't be seen, nor can he directly interact, and we don't know where he is. Of course, that deification stage leading to disembodiment by way of structural necessity must include the disappearing white straight line. Think of the cue ball and stick striking each other. The utter chaos of the act of breaking is caused by the combination. That's what you call combining the thrust of the straight line of the cue and the circle of the cue ball to start the game. Breaking. The circle, or sphere, in the form of the cue ball, or MDMA, gets slammed head-on by the disappearing white straight line, or cocaine. So here, what I believe likely caused Ryan to break, so to speak, is the combination of the three hits of MDMA, followed potentially by the disappearing white straight line of cocaine, which would satisfy structural necessity. I think his disembodiment came in the aftermath of the collision of those things, the three circles of the MDMA and the disappearing white straight line. Now, let's return to the pool table a moment. It will tell us where he ended up, more or less. Certainly not the location, but as a generality, structure dictates it will. So, we live in a binary universe, though not in a literal sense. Time goes forward and backward, yet ironically, in the same direction. I've explained that in the context of the infinite loop previously, but here I'll go just a bit deeper into the nuance. Before light appeared in the universe, the first thing that could be detected to substantiate the universe's existence, in contrast to total darkness, was essentially radiation, which can be viewed today, near the point of origin. It basically blocks our view of the point of origin in the universe, but what is theorized by scientists, yet also easily accessible in my weird spectrum brain, is that a mirror universe exists on the other side. So think of it this way. Our universe expands outward, away from the point of origin. And on the other side, the same thing is happening. So time is going in reverse for them, or away, in our perspective, yet if both universes were born at the same time, both would exist at the same point in history throughout their expansion. They would mirror each other. It isn't a separate universe. It's our own mirrored, and so we call it the mirror universe, or the dark half, or shadow, if you want to get all Jungian up in here. We exist in the light. The other half is dark. It works the same way as the alternating electricity we discussed. I mean, it's this simple. Just go outside and look at yourself in comparison to your shadow. That's all it is. That's the mirror universe, the darkness. So now, if you place the infinity symbol over your chest, or perhaps more appropriately, your back, you'd see that it bears similarity to your lungs, and that's because your lungs are designed to replicate the infinite loop, except that the loop feeds itself rather than taking in outside resources. It's self-sufficient. So the way each universe within an infinite loop is created is the same way it happens on a pool table. The break on the pool table is equivalent to the Big Bang populating the universe. It breaks apart the universe into opposing binary sides coded as 1-0, and so, in the game, one side, the solids, gets to be the zeros, while the other, the stripes, are ones. One and zero are simply akin to light and dark. One is light, zero is dark, one is on, zero is off. So in the universe, to maintain balance, we have the necessity of positive, negative, and neutral charges facilitating energy balancing to zero at all times. Therefore, on the pool table, in much the same way it works in religion, one person, the stripes, is playing the role of Jesus, and the other, the Antichrist, as the solids, or circles. So the idea is that you, as Jesus, want to banish all the solids back down into the abyss, while conversely, as the Antichrist, you want to banish all the stripes, or ones, to that same fate. Like it works in religious considerations in society, you either banish the Antichrist down to darkness, or he does it to you. Now, in our universe, the light has to ironically return to the place from which it came, which, to the best of our knowledge at this time, would be projected from and back into a structure combining the black hole and white hole. The black hole is the place into which the light goes, and the white hole is the other side from which the light comes out or is projected. So on the pool table, it works the same way. The balls are shot down into three sets of binary black holes known as pockets, or birth, life, death in a binary universe, with the disappearing straight white line of the action on the table being the deification stage, or 7. So, 3 sets of 2 pockets plus the moving straight white line that disappears. When it's over, you find the balls in the pockets and return them to the light. That process happens by way of the combination I just described involving the cue ball and the stick. So if that's the symbolic equivalent of what might have killed Ryan, then the most probable place his fate took him was, quite simply, a dark hole. And look what we notice. This incident happened in very cold weather. It's not like anybody buried him in the middle of the night in February outside a ski resort. Even with machinery, that would be a massive undertaking that would get you noticed. All we need to do is look at the pool table again. What do we see as apparent by the black holes that represent the place Ryan might be found? They're not covered, meaning symbolically that he isn't buried somewhere. If he's in a dark hole, it's accessible, and that fits perfectly within the framework of disposal in the middle of the night in a place that's literally freezing and has snow everywhere. That would be the best you could hope to accommodate if you were engaging in a cover-up. And the other thing is, a dark hole is consistent with a womb, and so on a psychological level, it's going to give the person putting him there the feeling that he will be reborn. Of course he will not, because it's a manifested narrative. It's not an emotional rebirth. So we're looking for a place that is dark, and perhaps below the surface somewhere. Below the mirror universe. Of course, since the ball sinking into the dark mirror universe of the pockets parallels the idea of sinking into the abyss, and water in the form of a lake's reflected or mirrored surface is intended to manifest the idea, he could also be underwater, because essentially he would not be covered. But again, ultimately, the symbolism lurking beneath the psychology says he isn't buried, which again fits the bill. Nobody could put a shovel in the ground. Of course, as the pool table is a bridge, and even the device used to span it to assist with the pool cue is called a bridge, from which the balls drop into the darkness of the pockets, I would definitely consider any body of water that exists below a bridge in the surrounding area that might have been accessible that night. In terms of his exact location, where he might have ended up, that's anybody's guess. Now, we understand the birth, life, death, deity structure and its binary distribution as it pertains to the pool table having 2 sets of 3 pockets on either side, along with a disembodied or disappearing straight white line, to make 7, or the number of the deity. The deity, again, is the singularity, the white light, and like semen, it slams into the universal chamber from the other, or binary side, breaking the singularity into an outrageous number of pieces, mimicked by the pool ball spreading. Even though for reasons of practicality, one person has to be the stripes, or ones, and the other the zeros, or solids, you'll notice all of the balls are still spherical, which symbolizes our need to extract the circle, or zero, in our evolutionary narrative in favor of making those zeros, or circles, straight lines. It's just like if you were cutting up cocaine on a table. If you poured some out of the bag, it would hit the table in a circle, and then you would cut it into a straight line. So again, on the pool table, and with MDMA, turning the circle into the straight line happens by way of what concept? Rolling. So in our first stop of the night, the place to which they're going should, in some way, indicate rolling the circle or sphere into the disappearing white line. Sounds crazy, but my brain is designed to extract construction of these events through symbolism. Now, since birth, life, death, followed by deification in a binary universe, can be written in multiple ways, pool is also played to accommodate. For instance, in the UK, pool is generally played with 16 balls, in order to accommodate the notion of the deification stage, or singularity, followed by the six, which represents the three binary stages of birth, life, death. In the U.S., pool is normally played with 22 balls, symbolizing the binary 1-1 formation of the universe. Universal completion, or deification, is the switch from 1-0 to 1-1, so in binary terms, 22 makes 11, or 1-1, twice. Of course, the two pool sticks equate to the straight lines as well, as 1-1. They're used to eliminate, or more specifically, flatten circles, transforming them to ones. We need to see that idea manifested in Ryan's first stop of the night, in this case, as we are utilizing the concept of rolling. So as Ryan heads out for the night, the place to which he goes first, for Act 1, so to speak, should be like the break on the pool table. It should foreshadow what's to come, even if in the most ludicrous way possible. You have to understand that your reality is something that is machine-generated, and so just like AI makes you laugh really hard today, that still happens on a much more subtle and intuitive way moving forward into the future. Like the pool cue and cue ball, using the concept of collision through rolling to turn the circle into the disappearing straight white line, or the MDMA into the cocaine, we need to see the same thing here. So what is this place called? Massa's. It's a bar and grill. This is our Act 1. On the surface, that name, Massa's, which is M-A-S-A in possessive form, doesn't mean much, but let's take a closer look. While this place is a bar and grill, and Massa is seemingly someone's name, elsewhere, Massa is a maize dough derived from ground corn. Created to make tortillas and similar, the idea is that you ball this white dough into a sphere, aka the circle, and then use a rolling pin to roll it or flatten it to the point it essentially becomes a two-dimensional plane upon which you'll put your universe, or food, inside before that straight white line of the tortilla disappears through the act of eating until it's gone. In your mind, that doesn't sound rational. It isn't. It's structural. This is how machines build your reality. Again, the same silly bullshit you notice AI doing in today's world persists into the future, yet by way of increased technological capability and better writing, it's hidden to accommodate most people. Unfortunately, I'm not one of them, so I suffer the fallout of having this information delivered explicitly rather than intuitively. You very likely live in a world comprised of reason and logic. I understand that world, and I play in it, but it doesn't exist any further than a facade that allows the greater part of society comfort in ignorance of how they're built, like the person who drives the car without knowing what's under the hood. It's perfectly normal. Not for me. Most of you, thankfully, are equipped with the scenic view from the windshield, but I got stuck with the view under the hood. This landscape is mechanical to me. It's a green screen full of mathematical necessity, like the balls on the table. Anyhow, the group stays at Massa's for one drink, and then moves on to their next destination. As we said earlier, Act 2 in a story is a descent into the abyss of the new world, the place in which you'll change. In a transcendence narrative, the protagonist undergoes emotional change. But in a tragedy, it's substituted with a physical shortcut, here being drug use. So again, because we're going down to the abyss, this place is appropriately called Bottoms, and that's what Act 2 is in any story. The abyss, the place of change from which you are supposed to rise, or remain if it's tragedy. But the thing about this is that that's where a protagonist goes at his lowest emotional point. And so, what he is going to want to do from this place moving forward is what? Get as high as possible. So, right now, he's down to the bottom of the abyss. And so we're at a place called Bottoms. And what is he going to do from here? He's going to get high. He's going to go up. Though this is perfectly normal, Ryan sinks because he's equipped with an emotional life that is not suited to the journey ahead. So in order to get back up the hill on the other side after crossing the abyss of transformation, he'll need to mature emotionally, specifically in the form of going from boy to man. Young people often indulge drugs, even just recreationally, as a means of coping with issues related to transcendence. Again, Ryan's usage seems fairly normal and common here. He's just a dude not quite sure of what he wants to do moving ahead in life, and is partying as a means of ascending or getting high in place of doing it through regular achievement, simply because many young people don't know what they want to do yet, and therefore don't accomplish very much. The partying acts as a way to mourn the death of their childhood. They don't quite know the path to the top of the mountain yet, as they lack experience, and so they seek a feeling of getting high physically, so to speak, whether it's using MDMA or getting on a chairlift to take your snowboard to the top and go down. Again, in the same way Ryan uses the drugs as an emotional lift to feel like he's at the top of the mountain, he also literally uses a lift to allow him the same. So Ryan is going to use drugs to feel like he's reached the top of the mountain on this night. But here's the tragedy involved. Let's ask this question. What do we never want to do when we reach the top of the mountain? Come down. Okay, so I'm going to wrap it up there for part one, and you can jump right over to part two now. It's available.